Welcome, everyone, to episode 83 of Underserved. Joining me today is Rachel Kosser, CEO and co-founder of Virtual Sapiens. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew, for having me. It is an honor to be here.
So way back in the day, instead of like locking yourself in the cellar and pounding out basic code, you're actually a rhythmic gymnast in your teens?
That's right. Yeah, leading all the way through my teens from the age of about 5, I was stretching aggressively instead of pounding away on a keyboard.
Now, what is rhythmic gymnastics? I looked on Wikipedia and like you do a floor routine and there's like an apparatus. Like, how does that work?
Yes. So you actually hit on one of the core differentiators between rhythmic gymnastics, which is what I did, and artistic gymnastics, which is with the flips and the uneven parallel bars and the beam. And as much as I hate to admit this, rhythmic gymnastics is the lesser known of the two, but it involves apparatus like ribbon and ball and hoops and ropes, and you throw things and you do all kinds of crazy stuff underneath, and then you catch stuff with your legs, and it's very entertaining, almost a cross between ballet and circus arts.
Okay, so what was the apparatus that you liked to work with?
I loved working with the ball. Every apparatus has a specialty, and the specialty with the ball was flexibility. And so I tended to be able to unlock pretty high scores because I could do some high level flexibility moves, and just loved, typically ball routines were a little bit slower, and I'm very tall, so I like to move a little more slowly. And yeah, I will say though that the biggest risk for the ball routine is to have the ball go flying across the gym if you don't catch it properly, or it like slips away from you. And I have had that happen, and I have had the ball go right under the judge's desk, and I have had to crawl underneath it while my music keeps playing to go and get this ball and come back to the carpet and finish my routine.
That's got to be brutal.
Yeah.
How many days a week are you doing this? How many hours a week are you training for this?
The training for rhythmic gymnastics is very aggressive. From a young age, you're training between 3 to 5 hours every day. Typically, you'll get one day off, and you're doing all of that at the same time as your schooling.
And how far did you take this? Is there like a club team or a national team?
Yeah, great question. There's a national team. So the Canadian national team is what I was a member of. Typically the top 10 to 8 athletes by ranking in the country, according to your age. So I was on the junior national team when I was younger, and then I was on the senior national team when I was older. And as a representative of Canada, as a gymnast, you travel all over the world and you get to compete in pretty wild places, from Russia to Bulgaria and Greece and Portugal, and meet other gymnasts all over the place, which is pretty interesting. But yeah, I did World Championships, World Cup, represented Canada for many years. Didn't make it to the Olympics. I was off on that cycle because it only happens once every 4 years, Summer Olympics. And when I retired, I was number 2 on the Canadian national team. And obviously, number 1 was going to the Olympics. So at that point, when I was about 17, I made the decision to switch over to ballet.
And so what do you do to switch to ballet?
So I had been training as a ballet dancer at the same time as I was doing rhythmic gymnastics. And so it was a question of figuring out which professional ballet environment would accept someone who had had a very different, atypical upbringing or training experience. So yes, I'd been to some of the national ballet schools, but rhythmic gymnastics was such a priority for me. So I was spending my time competing internationally and maybe not going through your core ballet curriculum. So when I showed up at Boston Ballet, you know, thankfully they were really interested in my background because it was diverse and different and gave me some advantages, particularly in the contemporary world of ballet and movement. So they were tolerant of my atypical background and welcomed me into their program.
I imagine, like, you know, here's a tall person with strength and flexibility. You must have been able to maybe do some things that the typical dancers couldn't.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And we had one of the resident choreographers at the time. So one of the artists who was with Boston Ballet and every year would create a new piece. He loved, his name's Yurima Ello, and he loved this more extreme athletic quality in his ballets. And he liked to leverage that. So he actually let me bring a lot of my rhythmic gymnastics onto the stage, which was very special for me.
But when you first get there, like, there's like different companies, right? There's like a first company, a second company. Like, do you make the top one right out of the gate, or do you have to work your way up?
Yeah, no, there's, when I first got there, there's the trainee program, which is the top level of the school. And you're training all day, but you're not in either of the company. You're not getting paid. And I was in that program for 2 years, which is pretty standard. And then I was offered a contract with the second company, which is like the apprentices, Boston Ballet 2, is what it's called. And I danced. So that was actually my first experience getting paid to dance, which was amazing. Because at that point, you're starting to feel like, wow, I feel like maybe I've kind of made it a little bit, you know, to get paid for something like ballet. And so I was in BB2 for 2 years. And then I was offered a full contract with the company. And that, you know, I stayed there within the full company for 6 years.
Now, are they touring everywhere or primarily performing in Boston, or how does that work?
So the home theater is the Boston Opera House, and that's where we perform our entire season. But I was fortunate to get to hop on a few international tours. We went to Spain for 6 weeks. We did Helsinki in Finland. We did London, which was a very special tour because that's when I actually met my husband. And Ottawa, New York, you know, I did get to dance on some of the most exciting, famous stages in the world.
But in 2013, there's a little hitch in the plan.
Yes. Yes. It's funny. I feel like I can very easily just like glaze over some of the really hard parts. But yeah, in 2013, which was the year of that tour in London, I sustained a really, what would end up being a career-ending injury to my ankle. And it was one of those things that kind of creeps in and you're kind of like, oh, that's uncomfortable. And so you start to ignore it. And even though the pain gets louder and louder, your tolerance also goes up. And next thing you know, I'm in London and I'm performing, but when I come off stage, I put a boot on and, you know, it's like, I'm really kind of falling to pieces physically. And I had a surgery. I took time off. I did injections. Like I really tried everything to heal this and come back. And it was very clear. I mean, I got another year of dancing in, but it wasn't the same. I was holding myself back. And I started to realize this sacrifice, this poor relationship that I had sacrificed everything for was no longer giving me what I needed from it. I wasn't able to dance with abandon anymore. I was having to deal and face pain every day. And, you know, eventually it became very clear that moving forward was just not the right decision for me.
But you spent 20 years at this point, 20 plus years, putting everything into it. Like, how do you even wrap your head around the next step?
So I had known that I was going to do something different after I retired. And even if you have an amazing injury-free career as a dancer, you really only make it to your 30s, right? If you're lucky. And that's a really strong run. So I retired when I was 27. Way, way earlier than I had anticipated. But I got my undergrad while I was dancing. So I was able to leave and enter the workforce. Now that doesn't mean that I didn't have like an insanely brutal crash landing when, you know, I had to overnight grapple with this complete change in identity and loss of an identity, right? Like one day you're this professional dancer and you're the biggest, most important asset to this company, this organization, and then the next day you're not. And it's really hard to face, especially when you're used to walking into a room full of people and saying, I'm a professional ballet dancer, and having everyone be like, wow, I've never met one of those before. Like, what is that like? That's so cool. And now, you know, I was like walking into these rooms being like, I don't know what I am or who I am.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's SYRINX.com.
So your first job working 9 to 5 in a cube, where's that?
At Harvard in their fundraising offices. And it was a cubicle. Yeah. I went from the stage to a cubicle. That was jarring.
And what were you doing at Harvard?
I was a development associate and assistant. So I was helping fundraisers prepare, and it was a very admin entry level role, helping them be prepared for their fundraising meetings with high level donors.
But you're probably more experienced and older than your peers that are probably doing this fresh out of college. What's that like?
I went in with a huge chip on my shoulder, to be honest. I thought I was above the job. I was like, I'm going to walk in there, and within a couple of weeks, they're going to realize how amazing I am and give me a promotion. And, you know, the opposite happened, because I didn't realize that actually there were a whole other set of skills, office skills that are very real, that I did not have. There was a specific kind of organization, a specific kind of stamina that was very different from being so ingrained and engrossed in this world of rehearsal and performance. And I had also initially viewed this job, this 9 to 5, as a non-physical job. And so I had turned off like a big part of myself when going into the office every day, and I was exhausted and I was getting back pain and knee pain. And I was like, what is happening? Like, I thought I left pain behind. And I had to pause for a moment and really realize and recognize that we will always have a physical experience. And there's actually a lot to leverage from the physical, nonverbal body language perspective, even in this, you know, what I'd considered to be in a non-physical space. To put it softly, it was a very important but very challenging year of learning for me.
So you grind out your time there. What do you end up moving on to?
So while I was there, actually, I did notice that thread of, well, if this is a physical job, what does that mean for the way we show up? And are there potentially some skills and lessons I'd learned as a dancer that could be applied to this new world? And turns out there were many lessons that I could bring over to my new life. And so I actually started experimenting with these presence and body language classes that I was doing for people in the hospitality restaurant industry. And I started this company called Choreography in the Kitchen initially, and would go to these, you know, high-level restaurants, and I would help the front of house staff become more aware of their bodies and help them figure out how they could stand with ease and move throughout a kind of complex, busy, bustling dining room in a way that's poised and graceful. And one of my managers at Harvard found out I was doing that and said, you know, I think this could actually be really interesting for fundraisers as well. And that really got me thinking that, okay, well, I mean, the play in restaurants was very obvious because it's such a performance, but maybe there's also something here for fundraisers, salespeople, leaders, client-facing professionals. And that led me down this whole rabbit hole to discover that many people were already doing this. There was a world and ecosystem of leadership presence and nonverbal communication training that companies would pay for. And so I started, you know, developing that body of work, and Choreography in the Kitchen became Choreography for Business. And I did end up going from Harvard to another fundraising role where I was actually bringing in the money. So I was the actual fundraiser, which was much more my speed. But all the while I was developing this consulting practice on the side. And I loved it because it really did give me a little bit more of a connection to this past that had such a concrete evolution towards something new. And it helped me see that this past experience I had could continue to evolve and didn't have to just be forgotten and kind of thrown away, you know, because the number of times when I was interviewing where people would be like, well, you know, yeah, that's like so cool that you danced, but like, we don't dance here, you know, it's like more, definitely more than one. So it was kind of an interesting evolutionary transition.
There's a thing on the entire East Coast where, like, we're interviewing people, we want to see that you've done it before. Mm-hmm. And if you've done something else before, people are like, oh, that's not this. You know, it's like, it's almost like gatekeeping.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that's like an East Coast thing, because I do feel like Boston sometimes is a little academic in the way that they approach things. in a little bit of a conservative way. And I did definitely experience that, even though ironically it was Harvard University that was the first place to actually give me a shot.
Now, the second place you were fundraising, was that for the New England Conservatory?
That's right. Yep.
And I got to imagine you could get behind the mission a little bit more there.
Definitely. I mean, New England Conservatory is such a gem. It's such a special place. The artists and musicians are amazing. And so, you know, getting to connect with that part of myself in the story of fundraising was definitely more natural. And I'll also say, you know, I was fortunate to have been hired by a woman who was a real visionary in the space, and fundraising with good reason gets a little bit of a bad rap because it tends to be stuck in the dark ages and all that. And she was really pushing things forward, and she really actually gave me so much opportunity there. So that was a very different experience from what I had at Harvard.
Do you want to give her a shout out?
Oh yeah. Her name's Kathleen Kelly. She's amazing, totally inspirational leader and visionary.
Very cool. Around this time, you also start doing some professional speaking?
Yes. Yes. All around this concept that I'd been developing around, you know, bringing physicality and embodiment and body language really to the forefront of communication within the workplace.
And are you like traveling? Are you doing it virtually? How are you delivering this?
All very much in person. Like, I did nothing virtually before the pandemic. I was actually a huge proponent for, like, if you can do it in person, do it. And yeah, then things changed.
So what happens to that on Friday, March 13th, 2020?
Oh, man. It was actually, you know, really hard, of course, initially for a variety of reasons. And I remember one of the things that I had trouble letting go of initially, as I think many people did, was the realization that things were fundamentally changing and new ways of working and communicating were coming online. And initially, you know, I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do, like, without in-person communication? And that's fair. But I did realize actually pretty quickly, now that I like kind of go back in time, I think it was a week in, I hosted my first virtual presence workshop. I was like, hey guys, like on Instagram, I'm going to host this virtual presence workshop, go over some best practices you can think about so that you can show up and feel more human and more connected on video. And like that little nugget is what has evolved and cascaded into this company, Virtual Sapiens, now that I'm running. And what's, I guess, most fascinating is that for someone who was such a diehard in-person champion, now I view video as, you know, a core human channel of communication that we can leverage and activate in a way that is very, very impactful, you know, alongside our in-person connection.
So let's say someone is scared, intimidated, inexperienced at communicating over video. What are your top things you should remember or top things you should avoid for that person to learn quickly?
That's a big question, Andrew. So what I will say are three things. The very first thing is that just because we're connecting over video through a screen doesn't mean that the person on the other side is not having a full-bodied, very 3D experience. And the more we can tap into their experience as an audience, the more alive, connected, expressive, and impactful we will be as a speaker. I think it's very easy and normal and natural to feel awkward and silly and disconnected when we're so focused on the fact that we're talking to a screen, right? We're talking to our laptop where we're used to doing all this work and crunching out numbers and banging away on the keyboard, right? But now it's this like activated human channel. So as much as we can bring that person's experience, whether we're live and interacting with them live or recording something asynchronously that they'll watch at a later date, either one of those instances, right, we want to have our audience top of mind so that we can really tap into that human connection. And that being the primary thing then leads us to, okay, if this person has a very specific perspective, one of the advantages to video is that we know what that perspective is going to be from a visual perspective. We know that they're looking at you from the lens. So we can orient our framing, we can orient our expression, we can orient our background to provide them with the most articulate, impactful, pleasant viewing experience, right? It doesn't have to be as two-dimensional as we may think it is.
Well, I would say my top two tips are get comfortable with staring into the lens.
Yes.
As much as you can, because yep. If you're looking down and not into the lens, doesn't matter how well you're speaking or how smart you are, like it's just not as much of a connection. In fact, we've set up teleprompters that have cameras behind them here at the office just so you can look at the person and look into the lens at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I would say my second tip is, I forget which famous director said it, but sound is half the picture. So if you could make yourself sound halfway decent, whether that's a boom mic or a separate mic or whatever, it really goes a long way towards helping establish presence and credibility over a video connection.
Yes, absolutely. The eye contact thing is key. And it goes back to that point of, you know, if their perspective is the lens, then look into the lens and it's like looking into their eyes, right? You don't want to stare into the lens. You don't want to not blink. You want to keep that regular eye contact cadence. But yes, you do want to anchor your eye gaze into the lens. And, you know, I really do appreciate you mentioning that bit about sound quality. I don't know how long you and I worked to get the sound just right for this, but it does make a huge difference. And again, like we're helping our audience pay attention to us by doing these things.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So you're figuring out new ways of engaging people. You go on Instagram and people are like, ooh, yes, I want to not sound and look terrible over Zoom. And that really resonates. What else are you doing towards like the summer of 2020?
So I was actually really leaning into this virtual presence facilitation. And I was doing a lot of facilitations live over Zoom with groups of salespeople. And I was working as a facilitator with other communication training firms who were also providing virtual presence work and was really just developing a body of work and really observing that there were a few things that consistently people were getting wrong. And a lot of the time that I was being paid to spend time coaching professionals, I was kind of going over the same thing over and over again. Things like, make sure your framing's proper, like lens at eye height, look into the lens, let's practice that. Remember to use your hand gestures. Like they're a very human aspect of our communication. We want to include that, like all of these things. And in, I think it was near end of August, I was like, I wonder, like, wouldn't it be cool if you could have a sidekick or like a buddy, like an AI friend that would just like sit on your Zoom call and be like, hey, I mean, like you're talking and you're not looking into the lens, or like you just did it again, you know, or like, whoa, move back. Like I know you're getting excited, but you're just making that viewing experience really intense with the person on the other end. Move back, give yourself more space. Like these little cues, I was like, wouldn't that be kind of cool? And that was like the very first time that I was like, actually, maybe I think there's something there. And I like pulled on that thread a little bit, spoke with some tech people to see if this crazy idea was actually feasible from a technology perspective. So yeah, tech CEO, zero experience in technology.
You talked to a friend who's a data scientist and said, can we teach a computer to recognize this? And what does your friend say?
Yeah. So this was Clayton Kim, who's actually come on board as one of our first advisors. And he did a little feasibility study. And he was like, some of these problems are pretty simple. Some of the problems are more complicated. And as I think any like first time founder, you tend to ignore and discount the things that people say are going to be a challenge. And you're just like, but it's possible, right? And he's like, yeah, it's possible, but it's going to be hard. And you're like, okay, that's fine. So long as it's possible, like, let's go for it. Let's figure it out. And so, you know, you bulldoze through some of those early conversations. And next thing you know, you have the start of something.
So you built an MVP. What happens next?
So I worked with a group of engineers in Ukraine initially. And we built out this MVP, which was basically like a browser-based AI monitoring system that would run in browser while you're on your video. And you wouldn't get like any nudges or anything. But after the call, you would get feedback on your framing, your lighting, and your posture. So those were the first three things that we tried. And we learned two things. We learned that it works, right? So the AI was very accurate, and we were able to provide pretty concrete feedback on these three metrics. We learned that people wanted more feedback. People were like, what about eye gaze? What about facial expressions? What about hand gestures, right? So there was this appetite, which was awesome. But then we also learned that we had a pretty big limitation with PC users. So while Mac users can have a couple of different applications accessing the webcam at the same time, PC users cannot. And so, you know, that was like an early issue that came up that we're actually still trying to figure out. But again, you know, I was like, it can't be impossible. There's got to be some ways to work around it. Here we are, a year and a half later.
And your demo helps you find a tech co-founder, right?
Yeah. You're right. Yeah. The other thing that I really learned after having gone through that experience was that I needed a technical person who was just thinking about this problem 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But I also really needed a partner. It was becoming very difficult for me to push this forward and to have conversations with investors and to really be, unfortunately, taken seriously. Because at the end of the day, I was this ballerina coming to the table talking about AI and body language. And people were like, yeah, we totally get that you'd be the person to do this. But like, how are you going to do this if you don't have like a technical partner? Didn't have to be a co-founder, could have been more of a CTO. And I did consider that. But at the end of the day, I wanted someone who was so fully bought in that I wouldn't have to wake up every day being like, oh, it's still like 100% up to me. You know, I really wanted a 50-50 partner. And I found that, or he found me, Neil found me on angel.co. And the MVP, having the MVP was a big piece of that. Because I think typically lots of technical people will get non-technical people coming up to them and saying, I have this idea, like, and I kind of like need someone to bring it to life. So like, do you want to be that person? And sometimes that works. But what's even better is like, I have this idea, I've been bringing it to life. And I, you know, I need a partner now to take it to the next level. It's kind of a different ask.
And so today you have some paid clients and you're looking at closing more?
That's right. Yes, we have people who pay for this, which is amazing. We have people who pay for this. We have some really exciting pilots that are in the process of converting into our first, you know, B2B contract and gaining some real early traction.
It's very similar to the story you said, like the first time you got paid to dance, you're like, oh, this is tremendously gratifying and, you know, makes me feel more legitimate. It sounds like same sort of experience when you got paid customers at Virtual Sapien.
100%. Definitely. I know there are different models and different ways to get things up and running, but I really do believe that especially with something as difficult to quantify as communication and, you know, the value of it is felt, but it can be hard to quantify it specifically. Like I felt pretty strongly about ensuring that people were paying to receive this value and feedback from the beginning, because it's a very different thing to just give away for free and have people use it versus having people like buy into it and like, you know, timestamp, like, yes, I value this. I'm going to spend my money on it and I'm going to improve accordingly.
Now, you got involved with Mass Challenge a year ago or so. How was that?
Yes. So, Mass Challenge was a really fantastic early stamp of approval and validation for us, having spent so much time in Boston. And actually, I had done workshops for Mass Challenge founders in the past where I'd gone in and given body language workshops. So to get to be a founder, to going through that program myself was special. And it was virtual. And Mass Challenge does accept a good number of companies. You know, it's very competitive, but they still accept 125 companies just in the Boston program. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of noise. It's really what you make of it in terms of reaching out and leveraging those mentors and getting real value out of it. And I'll say, you know, we were fortunate in connecting with some really stellar mentors and champions who worked with us throughout the entire time, you know, still in touch with them today. And the other interesting thing was that we went through this accelerator program when we were in a very intense build phase. I think it can sometimes be hard to leverage a network of connections when your product is so fledgling, kind of like a negotiation between like, how do I establish these relationships and do something with them, knowing that the product isn't like stable yet. So I definitely was still doing a lot of live coaching and manual assessments where we were, you know, presenting it as AI, but it was really just me in the background.
The puppet master behind the curtain.
The classic ice cream vending machine image.
So Mass Challenge is also where you met Syrinx consultant and Underserved podcast guest, Brandon Kindred.
That's right. Yeah. Shout out to Brandon. He is the best. He's the best. Yes.
You participated in Techstars as well, right?
I'm currently at Techstars as we speak. Yes. At the Northeastern Rue Institute program.
And what's that like?
It has been amazing. I have to say, you know, Techstars is a little bit of a different animal when you compare it to Mass Challenge, right? It's these cohorts are 10 companies only and super, super specialized around the companies who are there. The programming is very intense. You know, we just got done with our mentor magic 2 weeks. And I pause there because it used to be called Mentor Madness and they rebranded it. And I get why they did, but I actually think it should just be called Mentor Madness. Because you meet with 60 mentors over the course of 2 weeks and you're just, it's like speed dating. You're going through these meetings, 20 minutes each. You have to be so fast in describing your company and your mission and seeing if there's a connection, what you can get out of it. So, I mean, it's a lot.
So what's next for you and for Virtual Sapience?
We're in a very exciting place now with Virtual Sapience. You know, Techstars, I think, is going to be huge for us. We have some very exciting customers and potential partnerships that will be activated. You know, the goal is moving into 2023, they'll be activated and running. And I think, you know, while our products right now, we have two ways of experiencing Virtual Sapience and getting feedback, are very focused on helping you understand the way people may be perceiving you on video and how you can improve that. You know, once we are able to partner with other companies who may leverage other insights, like what is being said in the transcription and, you know, timelines and call timelines and events, I think we're really able to take our insights to the next level. And the whole idea here is that video presents a very compelling opportunity to bring specific insights to life in a way that would actually be very, very difficult to do in person, right? We are used to and accustomed to recording things and leveraging technology over video. And that presents many opportunities for us to have a conversation that is almost amplified, right? And it's not like we're not going to be using video for every single call, but for the calls that we do use it for, like what else is there for us to tap into to make those calls as impactful and powerful as possible? We feel like we're at the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of folks, a lot of companies are trying to get folks back into the office, but at least in the tech industry, you know, people seem to be topping out at 1 or 2 days a week back in the office. So I think virtual communication and video communication are here to stay. And as long as people want to be any good at it, I think there'll be a demand for your services.
Well, I agree. Thank you for saying that.
So you have an unusual hobby. In your spare time, you're a trapeze artist?
Yes. Yes, I'm obsessed. It's my new thing and I'm obsessed.
How do you get into that?
Actually, this is a really interesting story, but the Clayton Kim, who I mentioned was our first advisor, he is an amateur kind of professional circus artist in his spare time. And I had spent a lot of time with him just kind of playing around. He has this whole like rigged setup in his apartment in LA that's ridiculous. But I, you know, I played around with it and it was fun. And then my husband and I were digital nomads. So we spent a lot of time in Miami. And Miami just happens to have this thriving circus scene. And we went and saw a show with Clay. And I was so blown away. And I just, for the first time really since my time dancing, I saw something that I felt like I could really do that was very well aligned with my skill set. It was not going to be aggravating to my injuries because you're up in the air. So you're not experiencing impact in the same way that you typically do with sports, particularly in your ankles. And I just happened to get connected with the right people at the right time. You know, the Miami circus scene was very warm and open and welcoming. And I got connected with my coach and, you know, she's ex-Cirque du Soleil and she's just like so inspiring. And yeah, and I just totally fell for it hard.
Now, I've been accused of having GAS, gear acquisition syndrome, when it comes to audio and video stuff. What's the gear acquisition like for trapeze?
I'm so glad you asked because I actually did buy a trapeze. I resisted because especially having spent my entire childhood lugging around hoops and like ribbons and clubs on planes and just getting so many side looks. I was like, the last thing I need right now is to have a massive trapeze that I'm carrying around. But I am so glad I did. And my husband was so supportive. He, you know, he gifted it to me. And because we are digital nomads and we move around a lot, having the trapeze myself means that I can actually more quickly get back to trapeze. I don't have to depend on there being, you know, a fully built out circus school. I just need to make sure there's like a secure enough rigging situation. So I have to say, here in Portland, Maine, there is like an absence, it's like a void of circus arts schools. It took me like a month to figure this out, but I finally found a rock climbing gym, right? Where, you know, a lot of their business depends on secure rigging at height. And I convinced them to let me hang my trapeze up at their rock climbing studio. So now I have my trapeze up and I get to go and do my thing. And it's awesome.
That's cool. Well, you'll have to get some pictures for our show notes. And I remind our listeners that for each episode, we will include some show notes that will have links to additional information from topics that we discussed. And you can find that where you find our website, underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like FM radio. And you can also find us on Apple Podcasts and Google Play. So, Rachel, anything else that you're interested in, passionate about?
Well, I'll always have a soft spot for the arts. You know, the arts obviously took a huge beating during the pandemic. And so, you know, getting out even just locally within your community, seeing what's on offer and what people are doing is one of the best ways I think that you can meet people and get a good sense for what's going on in people, on people's minds. And from a creative perspective too, doing whatever art you feel is connected to your own form of expression. So it doesn't have to be anything fancy, but that's kind of my one parting note.
I like it. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew, for having me.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.